too much death. All of us arrive on earth with souls in perfect form. But from the moment of birth onward, the soul or true self is assailed by deforming forces from without and within, by racism, sexism, economic injustice, and other social cancers, by jealousy, resentment, self-doubt, fear, and other demons of the inner life. Most of us can make a long list of the external enemies of the soul, in the absence of which we are sure we would be better people. Because we so quickly blame our problems on forces out there, we need to see how often we conspire in our own deformation. For every external power bent on twisting us out of shape, there is a potential collaborator within us. When our impulse to tell the truth is thwarted by threats of punishment, it is because we value security over being truthful. When our impulse to side with the weak is thwarted by threats of lost social standing, it is because we value popularity over being a pariah. The powers and principalities would hold less sway over our lives if we refused to collaborate with them. But refusal is risky, so we deny our own truth, take up lives of self-impersonation, and betray our identities. And yet, the soul persistently calls us back to our birthright form, back to lives that are grounded, connected, and whole. Skepticism about true self. "This is the first, wildest, and wisest thing I know," says Mary Oliver, "that the soul exists and that it is built entirely out of attentiveness." But we live in a culture that discourages us from paying attention to the soul or true self, and when we fail to pay attention, we end up living soulless lives. Two streams in our culture contribute to our inattention. One is secularism, which regards the human self as a social construct with no created core. The other is moralism, which regards all concern for self as selfish. Secularism and moralism may sound contradictory, but they take us to the same place, a denial of true self. If we accept their distortions of reality, the journey toward an undivided life becomes a fool's errand. So it is important to understand why both assessments of our condition are wrong. Secularism holds that we arrive in the world not as unique individuals, but as malleable raw material that receives the imprint of the gender, class, and race into which we happen to be born. We have an inherited nature, of course, a set of potentials and limits received on our roll of the genetic dice. But from a secular standpoint, it is nonsense to believe that we are born with an inviolable soul, an ontological identity, a core of created selfhood. And yet, even in the face of this cynicism, the idea of true self persists, not because of some theory, but because of experiences we would not and could not have if true self were an illusion. For example, things fall apart for someone we care about. He makes bad choices and falls into despair, and we cannot understand why. This is not the person we know, we lament. He is simply not himself. Or things come together for someone we care about. After years of self-alienation, she learns to love her own life. She has come into her own, we exult. She has finally discovered who she really is. We perceive true self in people we know and care about, and we constantly use that perception as a benchmark of their well-being. Deeper still, we find evidence of true self in our own self-awareness, in experiences we would not have if biology, psychology, and sociology were the whole of who we are. I know I have a true self when I encounter a painful truth that my ego has tried hard to evade and am compelled by the inner teacher to confront it. I know I have a true self when my self-protective heart opens up and another person's joy or suffering fills me as if it were my own. I know I have a true self when desolation visits and I lose my taste for life and yet find within myself a life force that will not die. But the strongest evidence for true self comes from seeing what happens when we try to live as if we did not have one, a lesson I learned on my journey with clinical depression. Depressions come from a variety of causes, of course. Some result from genetic bad luck or imbalanced brain chemistry and must be treated with drugs. But others result from burying true self so deep that life becomes one long, dark night of the soul. My depression was of that kind. It responded to drugs only temporarily, returning again and again until I embraced my own truth. The notion that depression may result from defying one's truth has received indirect support from science. Randolph Ness, director of the Evolution and Human Adaptation Program at the University of Michigan, suggests that depression may have developed as an evolutionary response to situations in which a desired goal is unattainable, situations in which one of life's paths peters out into the woods. Depression, Ness argues, so thoroughly drains us of will and energy that we are unable to continue on a path that once seemed desirable but is, for us at least, impassable. We must find another way, a way more suited to our nature, thus contributing to individual survival and the evolutionary success of the species. Since one of the soul's functions is to give us life and get us to pass it along, which is soul language, I suppose, for evolutionary success, I find it hard to distinguish here between a biological adaptation and an uprising of the soul. In fact, the metaphor Ness chose to help explain his theory, the path that peters out into the woods, is most famously found in Dante, that master cartographer of the soul's domain. Midway on our life's journey, I found myself in dark woods, the right road lost. In my own case, at any rate, depression was the soul's call to stop, turn around, go back, and look for a path I could negotiate. If one ignores that call and doggedly presses on, the depression that comes from getting crosswise with true self can yield something worse than melancholy and lassitude, a deep desire to end one's life. Such was the case with me, and looking back, I understand why. When I was living my outer life at great remove from inner truth, I was not merely on the wrong path. I was killing my selfhood with every step I took. When one's life is a walking death, the step into literal death can seem very easy to take. Medication may offer temporary relief from depressions of this sort, but the real cure goes beyond drugs. We can reclaim our lives only by choosing to live divided no more. It is a choice so daunting, or so it seems in the midst of depression, that we are unlikely to make it until our pain becomes unbearable, the pain that comes from denying or defying true self. Secularism denies true self by regarding us as raw material. Moralism, the pious partner in this odd couple, achieves the same end by translating self into selfishness, and insisting that we banish the word from our vocabulary. The whole problem with our society, the moralists claim, is that too many people are out for themselves at the expense of everyone else. This New Age emphasis on self-fulfillment, this constant cult of me, is the root cause of the fragmentation of community that we see all around us. Or so the moralists argue. Deep caring about each other's fate does seem to be on the decline. But I do not believe that New Age narcissism is much to blame. The external causes of our moral indifference are a fragmented mass society that leaves us isolated and afraid, an economic system that puts the rights of capital before the rights of people, and a political process that makes citizens into ciphers. These are the forces that allow, even encourage, unbridled competition, social irresponsibility, and the survival of the financially fittest. The executives who brought down major corporations by taking indecent sums off the top, while wage earners of modest means lost their retirement accounts, were clearly more influenced by capitalist amorality than by some New Age guru. But before I go too far in assigning blame, let me name the real problem with the moralists' complaint. There is scant evidence for their claim that the cult of me reigns supreme in our land. I have traveled this country extensively and have met many people. Rarely have I met people with the overweening sense of self the moralists say we have, people who put themselves first as if they possessed the divine right of kings. Instead, I have met too many people who suffer from an empty self. They have a bottomless pit where their identity should be, an inner void they try to fill with competitive success, consumerism, sexism, racism, or anything that might give them the illusion of being better than others. We embrace attitudes and practices such as these not because we regard ourselves as superior, but because we have no sense of self at all. Putting others down becomes a path to identity, a path we would not need to walk if we knew who we were. The moralists seem to believe that we are in a vicious circle, where rising individualism and the self-centeredness inherent in it cause the decline of community, and the decline of community in turn gives rise to more individualism and self-centeredness. The reality is quite different, I think. As community is torn apart by various political and economic forces, more and more people suffer from the empty self syndrome. A strong community helps people develop a sense of true self, for only in community can the self exercise and fulfill its nature, giving and taking, listening and speaking, being and doing. But when community unravels and we lose touch with one another, the self atrophies and we lose touch with ourselves as well. Lacking opportunities to be ourselves in a web of relationships, our sense of self disappears, leading to behaviors that further fragment our relationships and spread the epidemic of inner emptiness. As I view our society through the lens of my journey with depression, an extreme form of the empty self syndrome, an experience of self-annihilation just short of death, I am convinced that the moralists have got it wrong. It is never selfish to name, claim, and nurture true self. There are selfish acts, to be sure, but those acts arise from an empty self, as we try to fill our emptiness in ways that harm others, or in ways that harm us and bring grief to those who care about us. When we are rooted in true self, we can act in ways that are life-giving for us and all whose lives we touch. Whatever we do to care for true self is, in the long run, a gift to the world. Tales of the Divided Life. We arrive in this world undivided, integral, whole. But sooner or later, we erect a wall between our inner and outer lives, trying to protect what is within us or to deceive the people around us. Only when the pain of our dividedness becomes more than we can bear do most of us embark on an inner journey toward living divided no more. I want to examine these life passages in more detail, so I need to ask you to make, or imagine making, a simple visual aid. Take a letter-sized piece of paper. Cut a half-inch strip down the long side. Hang on to the strip and throw the rest away. I apologize for this cheap, low-tech device, but I am a Quaker, and this is as close as we get to a PowerPoint presentation. Let one side of that strip represent your outer or onstage life. Here, the words that describe our experience are image, influence, and impact. Words that name our hopes and fears as we interact with the world. Is anyone listening to me? Am I making any difference? And how do I look while I'm trying? Let the other side of that strip represent your inner or backstage life. Here the vocabulary is less anxious and more reflective, with words like ideas, intuitions, feelings, values, faith. And deeper still, whatever words you choose to name the source from which such things come. Mind, heart, spirit, true self, soul, or place beyond all naming. The relation between our backstage and onstage lives unfolds, I suggest, through four phases. Phase one comes when we arrive in this world with no separation at all between our inner and outer life. This is why most of us love to be around infants and young children. What we see is what we get. Whatever is inside an infant comes immediately to the outside, both figuratively and literally. In the presence of a newly minted human being, I am reminded of what wholeness looks like, and I am sometimes moved to wonder, whatever became of me? This phase in the relation of our onstage and backstage lives requires no visual aid. We can see it all around us in the lives of the very young. But our Quaker PowerPoint starts to become useful as we turn to phase two, that long life passage in which we build and buttress a barrier between inner truth and the outer world. So let that strip of paper, one end held in each hand, stretched out left to right at eye level, the flat surface facing you, represent the wall of separation we erect as we depart childhood en route to becoming adolescents and adults. Some children, sadly, need this wall at home. Others do not need it until they get to school. But sooner or later, everyone needs a wall for the same reason, to protect our inward vulnerabilities against external threats. As it starts to dawn on us that the world is a dangerous place, we wall off the most fragile parts of ourselves, beliefs we hold, dimensions of our own identities, in hopes of protecting them, sometimes against great odds. I think, for example, of the plight of many gay and lesbian young people in a society that disapproves of them. Stuart Mathis was a gay man who grew up in a religious community that regards homosexuality as sin. His church insisted that he change his sexual orientation, and when he found it impossible to do so, he committed suicide, leaving these words behind. My church has no idea that as I type this letter, there are surely boys and girls on their calloused knees imploring God to free them from this pain. They hate themselves. They retire to bed with their fingers pointed to their heads in the form of a gun. I am now free. I am no longer in pain, and I no longer hate myself. As it turns out, God never intended for me to be straight. Perhaps my death might be a catalyst for some good. I feel nothing but compassion for people, young or old, who believe they can escape the world's cruelty only by wearing a disguise. But people sometimes wall off their truth for reasons that can only be called sinister. They conceal their identity from others because the deception provides them with a perverse form of power. The story of Saddam Hussein, ex-president of Iraq, vividly illustrates the point. Saddam rose to power by ingratiating himself within the ranks of the then-reformist Ba'ath Party until he had achieved enough leverage to murder the competition and consolidate his dictatorship. Hamed al-Jubouri, a former leader of the reformers, describes the capacity for dividedness that helped create Saddam's reign of terror. In the beginning, the Ba'ath Party was made up of the intellectual elite of our generation. There were many professors, physicians, economists, and historians. Really, the nation's elite. Saddam was charming and impressive. He appeared to be totally different from what we learned he was afterward. He took all of us in. We wondered about him. How could such a young man, born in the countryside north of Baghdad, become such a capable leader? He seemed both intellectual and practical. But he was hiding his real self. For years he did this, building his power quietly, charming everyone, hiding his true instincts. He has a great ability to hide his intentions. It may be his greatest skill. I remember his son Uday said one time, "My father's right shirt pocket doesn't know what is in his left shirt pocket." A case like Saddam's highlights the pathology of the divided life. But it is so large and so dramatic that it may lead us to ignore our own, less visible versions of the same disease. So let me use my journey into dividedness as a garden variety example of phase two. I was blessed with a family where it felt safe to be myself, so my dividedness did not begin at home. But I did not feel safe at school, despite my capacity to act the role of a successful and popular student. Words I put in quotation marks because the role felt so fraudulent to me. While I played my onstage part, my true self hid out backstage, fearful that the world would crush its deepest values and beliefs, its fragile hopes and yearnings. The farther I went with my education, the less safe school became. In graduate school especially, my emotional and spiritual survival seemed to depend on keeping my truth tucked away. When I did my doctoral work in the sociology of religion, I was, as I still am, a person of religious conviction. I did not expect my professors to share my religious beliefs, or even to hold any beliefs that might be called religious. But I assumed that they would give religious phenomena the same kind of scholarly respect that historians give primary texts, or geneticists give DNA, or physicists give subatomic particles. I soon learned that such was not always the case. Some sociologists of religion are driven by a desire to debunk all things religious. Intimidated by professors who took this approach, I did my best during graduate school to keep my beliefs undercover. All the while, I confess, taking secret solace from W. H. Auden's witty 11th commandment, "Thou shalt not commit a social science." I clung to the fantasy that once I had finished my degree and could take control of my professional fate, I would no longer have to hide my truth. But I soon learned that graduate school was a picnic compared to the world of work. The deeper I moved into that world, the more need I felt to wall off my true self, trying, to put it simply, to appear smarter and tougher than I really was. At first, I needed a wall to hide my vulnerabilities from the assaults of the world. But selfhood, hidden from strangers, soon becomes hidden from intimates as well. The wall I reinforced to protect myself at work was not easily dismantled in the company of family and friends. I began, without even knowing it, to keep true self tucked away in my personal as well as professional life. Then, and in retrospect inevitably, I began hiding my truth from myself as well. Here is the ultimate irony of the divided life. Live behind a wall long enough, and the true self you tried to hide from the world disappears from your own view. The wall itself and the world outside it become all that you know. Eventually, you even forget that the wall is there, and that hidden behind it is someone called you. Living behind a wall has at least three consequences. First, our inner light cannot illuminate the work we do in the world. When I was a young professor, walling off true self from the pressures of the tenure system meant sacrificing my teacher's heart. I lectured not to help my students learn, but to prove how professorial I was. My teaching in those days was too often guided by signals from the planet called academic success, instead of signals from within that could have kept me connected to my students' needs. I was not teaching by my best lights, and I am afraid that I too often left my students in the dark. Second, when we live behind a wall, our inner darkness cannot be penetrated by the light that is in the world. In fact, all we can see out there is darkness, not realizing how much of it is of our own making. As a young man, the wall allowed me to cast my own darkness on others while remaining blissfully ignorant of how they saw me. I remember with regret the arrogance that overcame me in my 30s when I became privately judgmental of many people I knew, a posture that was of course no more than projected self-doubt. From time to time, courageous friends tried to shed light on my shadow, with predictable results. I judged them to be arrogant and refused to listen. Third, when we live behind a wall, people close to us become wary of the gap between our onstage performance and backstage reality. Distrusting our duplicity and seeking to protect themselves, they hold us at arm's length. Relationships in which we might have a chance to see ourselves more clearly disappear from our lives, as the very people who could help us see the light are repelled by the force of our shadow, we end up inhabiting a closed system, an all-embracing and self-referencing hell. Or so it was with me. Life on the Mobius Strip. How does a closed system crack open? When the wall between soul and role blocks all external challenges that might stimulate self-knowledge, how do we even become aware that we are dangerously detached from both the world and true self? Here, true self will come to our rescue if we let it. The divided life is pathological, so it always gives rise to symptoms. And if we acknowledge the symptoms, we may be able to treat the disease. In my case, the symptoms became impossible to ignore. My depression returned in full force, and I was compelled to ask myself, who am I? Not as an abstract exercise, but with the urgency of real life. Not everyone gets depressed, of course. Some people start feeling aimless or anxious or angry. But at some point in phase two, having lived behind the wall for a while, most of us feel the pain of being alienated from our own truth. If we are willing to feel it and name it, instead of trying to numb it, this pain will crack our closed system open, forcing us out from behind the wall toward the healing vision of phase three. In this phase, we reach for integration by reordering our onstage lives around our backstage values and beliefs, as can be illustrated with our Quaker PowerPoint. Take that strip of paper you were holding as a wall and join the ends together. The circle you have formed represents the yearning that drives phase three. I want my inner truth to be the plumb line for the choices I make about my life, about the work I do and how I do it, about the relationships I enter into and how I conduct them. This is the yearning to be centered, a word that is, I would guess, one of the most frequently encountered in the spiritual literature of recent decades. The desire to center our outer lives on inner truth is a step toward integrity, of course. But, as our visual aid reveals in a way words alone cannot, phase three has a shadow side. Hold that ring of paper horizontally, as if it were a corral, and you will see that getting centered could also be described as getting the wagons in a circle, or moving into a gated community, or creating a secret garden where we welcome only those with whom we feel at ease. The shadow side of phase three arises when we use inner truth as a filter to exclude anyone or anything we find challenging. Real-world examples are common. Witness the divisive role religion often plays in public life, where believers on both the left and the right separate the good guys from the bad guys along doctrinal lines. When we use our truth to create such divisions, we fall far short of the open-hearted engagement with the world that all the great spiritual traditions advocate. Now the circle of phase three becomes no more than the wall of phase two in disguise. Which brings us to the final phase in the relation of our onstage and backstage lives, where the Quaker PowerPoint becomes essential. Take that strip of paper you have been holding in the shape of a circle. Pull the two ends slightly apart. Give one end a half twist, and then rejoin the two ends. You have just created a remarkable form called a Möbius strip. Holding the strip together with the fingers of one hand, use a finger on the other hand to trace what seems to be the outside surface of that strip. Suddenly and seamlessly, you find yourself on what seems to be the inside of the strip. Continue to trace what seems to be the inside surface of the strip. Suddenly and seamlessly, you find yourself on what seems to be the outside of the strip. I have to keep repeating what seems to be, because there is no inside and outside on the Möbius strip. The two apparent sides keep co-creating each other. The mechanics of the Möbius strip are mysterious, but its message is clear. Whatever is inside us continually flows outward to help form or deform the world, and whatever is outside us continually flows inward to help form or deform our lives. The Möbius strip is like life itself. Here, ultimately, there is only one reality. When we understand phase four in the relation of our onstage and backstage lives, we see that phases two and three are illusions. Necessary illusions, perhaps, at certain points in our lives, but illusions nonetheless. We may fool ourselves into believing that we are hiding our truth behind a wall, or using our truth to screen out what is alien to us. But whether we know it or not, like it or not, accept it or not, we all live on the Mobius Strip all the time. There is no place to hide. We are constantly engaged in a seamless exchange between whatever is out there and whatever is in here, co-creating reality, for better or for worse. The implications of this simple truth are widely ignored in a culture that separates inner from outer, private from public, personal from professional. When I speak to college faculty, for example, about the myth of values-free teaching, proposing that teachers should be open and upfront about their values, I get arguments from people who believe that it would be unprofessional to take their values into the classroom. Having seen the inevitability of life on the Mobius Strip, I can think of only one way to respond. Who else are you going to send in there, then? If you are in the room, your values are in there, too. And if you do not believe that, you have not been paying attention. Students are quite adept at psyching out what their teachers believe. That is how students survive. When professors, or politicians, or parents think they can mask who they are, they delude themselves and make the situation less trustworthy for others, contributing to the sense of danger that leads people to withhold self-investment. In this fourth phase of the relation between our onstage and backstage lives, we see that we have only one choice. Either we walk the Mobius Strip wide awake to its continual interchanges, learning to co-create in ways that are life-giving for ourselves and others, or we sleepwalk on the Mobius Strip, unconsciously co-creating in ways that are dangerous and often death-dealing to relationships, to good work, to hope. All of the great spiritual traditions want to awaken us to the fact that we co-create the reality in which we live. And all of them ask two questions intended to help keep us awake. What are we sending from within ourselves out into the world, and what impact is it having out there? What is the world sending back at us, and what impact is it having in here? We are continually engaged in the evolution of self and world, and we have the power to choose moment by moment between that which gives life and that which deals death. In phase four, we come full circle to the place where we began. For the Mobius Strip is the adult version of the wholeness into which we were born. As T.S. Eliot famously said, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." Of course, adult wholeness is far more complex than the wholeness of infancy. It cannot be reduced to embracing the inner child. As adults, we carry burdens and challenges children do not have. The burden of our failures, betrayals, and griefs. The challenges of our gifts, our skills, and our visions. And we must carry all of it consciously as we travel the Mobius Strip. We can survive, and even thrive, amid the complexities of adulthood by deepening our awareness of the endless inner-outer exchanges that shape us and our world, and of the power we have to make choices about them. If we are to do so, we need spaces within us and between us that welcome the wisdom of the soul, which knows how to negotiate life on the Mobius Strip with agility and grace. What it means to be hospitable to the soul, in solitude and in community, is the topic of the next chapter. Chapter 4. Being alone together, a community of solitudes. Our disasters come from letting nothing live for itself, from the longing we have to pull everything, even friends, into ourselves and let nothing alone. Robert Bly. On letting things alone. If we want to create spaces that are safe for the soul, we need to understand why the soul so rarely shows up in everyday life. The poet Robert Bly offers one explanation. It is our powerful ego drive to pull everything into ourselves and let nothing live for itself. Behind that drive is our disbelief in the reality and power of the inner teacher. Convinced that people lack inner guidance and wishing to help them, we feel obliged to tell others what we think they need to know and how we think they ought to live. Countless disasters originate here, between parents and children, teachers and students, supervisors and employees. Originate, that is, in presumptuous advice-giving that leaves the other feeling diminished and disrespected. But we can learn a more creative way to be present to each other, as the following story shows. It is the story of a conflicted person who was transformed because the people around her chose to trust her inner teacher, overcoming their long-time habit of pulling everything into themselves. It happened in a long-term circle of trust I facilitated for public school teachers. One of them, Linda, was a woman at the end of her rope. After 15 years of teaching, she had nothing good to say about her supervisors, her colleagues, or her students. All of them, by her account, were misguided and sometimes malevolent. She felt certain that she would be a happier person and a better teacher if only she could replace all these annoying aliens with actual human beings. The teachers who sat with Linda listened to her receptively and respectfully. Occasionally, they asked an honest, open question to help her say and hear more deeply what was troubling her. But guided by the ground rules of this form of community, which are explored later in this book, they offered no commentary, no argument, and no advice. Instead, they held her in a space where Linda was compelled to listen to herself. This turned out to be a revolutionary experience for someone whose cynical view of humanity had continually been reinforced by the people to whom she complained. I do not mean the few who agreed with her. I mean those who told her she was wrong and tried to talk her out of her cynicism, as well as those who turned their backs in disgust and walked away. "See," Linda would say to herself, "I was right about people. No one gets it, and no one cares." Like most of us, Linda knew how to use rejection to reinforce her view of the world. I learned how revolutionary it had been for Linda to listen to herself when she told me, after several retreats, that she intended to drop out. "It's not that I don't appreciate the group," she said. "In fact, being here has helped me understand that I don't belong in teaching anymore. The problem is not my students and colleagues. They're decent people doing the best they can. The problem is me. I've burned out on teaching, and I'm harming myself as well as others by sticking with it. I've decided to quit at the end of this year and find a different kind of job, so I guess I shouldn't be taking up space in this circle anymore." In fact, Linda had made courageous use of her space in the circle. She had seen her shadow, stopped projecting it onto others, come to grips with her own reality, and taken a step toward wholeness. I told her she was welcome to stay. A circle of trust, I said, has no agenda except to help people listen to their own souls and discern their own truth. Its purpose is not to help people recommit to a particular role or even become better at it, though one or both may happen. The fact that Linda had seen her shadow and now felt led to leave teaching was no less important than the vocational renewal that was happening for others in the group. Linda stayed and continued to make good use of this community. She emerged more fully from her shadow, grieved the loss of her longtime calling, and found clues to a new vocational path that fit her gifts. She was able to listen to herself because she was with people who knew how to let her alone without abandoning her. Let her be alone, that is, with her inner teacher. Solitude and community. As the story of Linda suggests, a circle of trust is community in a different key. Community, an elusive word with many shades of meaning, sometimes points to a group of people with a shared commitment to making an external impact of some sort, from changing one another to changing the world. But a circle of trust has no such agenda. Though people's lives may be changed in such a circle, and that in turn may change the world a bit, the circle itself is focused on inward and invisible powers. Its singular purpose is to support the inner journey of each person in the group, to make each soul feel safe enough to show up and speak its truth, to help each person listen to his or her inner teacher. In a circle of trust, we practice the paradox of being alone together, of being present to one another as a community of solitudes. Those phrases sound like contradictions because we think of solitude and community as either or. But solitude and community, rightly understood, go together as both and. To understand true self, which knows who we are in our inwardness and whose we are in the larger world, we need both the interior intimacy that comes with solitude and the otherness that comes with community. When we split solitude and community into an either-or and act as if we can get along with only one or the other, we put ourselves in spiritual peril. The theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer warned us about this risk in his classic Life Together. Let the person who cannot be alone beware of community. Let the person who is not in community beware of being alone. Bonhoeffer's warning is based on two simple truths. We have much to learn from within, but it is easy to get lost in the labyrinth of the inner life. We have much to learn from others, but it is easy to get lost in the confusion of the crowd. So we need solitude and community simultaneously. What we learn in one mode can check and balance what we learn in the other. Together they make us whole, like breathing in and breathing out. But exactly how solitude and community go together turns out to be trickier than breathing. When we say we are in solitude, we often bring other people with us. Think of how often our solitude is interrupted by an interior conversation with someone who is not there. When we say we are in community, we often lose track of true self. Think of how easily we can forget who we are when we get entangled in group dynamics. If we are to hold solitude and community together as a true paradox, we need to deepen our understanding of both poles. Solitude does not necessarily mean living apart from others. Rather, it means never living apart from oneself. It is not about the absence of other people. It is about being fully present to ourselves, whether or not we are with others. Community does not necessarily mean living face to face with others. Rather, it means never losing the awareness that we are connected to each other. It is not about the presence of other people. It is about being fully open to the reality of relationship, whether or not we are alone. When we understand solitude and community in these ways, we also understand what it means to create a circle of trust, a space between us that is hospitable to the soul, a community of solitudes where we can be alone together. If the idea of creating a space between us sounds exotic or bizarre, consider the fact that we do it all the time. Whenever people come together, in numbers large or small, we create different kinds of spaces to support different purposes. We know how to create spaces that invite the intellect to show up, analyzing reality, parsing logic, and arguing its case. Such spaces can be found, for example, in universities. We know how to create spaces that invite the emotions into play, reacting to injury, expressing anger, and celebrating joy. They can be found in therapy groups. We know how to create spaces that invite the will to emerge, consolidating energy and effort on behalf of a shared goal. They can be found in task forces and committees. We certainly know how to create spaces that invite the ego to put in an appearance, polishing its image, protecting its turf, and demanding its rights. They can be found wherever we go. But we know very little about creating spaces that invite the soul to make itself known. Apart from the natural world, such spaces are hard to find, and we seem to place little value on preserving the soul spaces in nature. I am not suggesting that the intellect, emotions, will, and ego are irrelevant to inner work. Operating independently, these faculties will not take us where the soul wants to go, but they are all vital parts of being human, and with guidance from the soul, they can all become vital allies on the journey toward an undivided life. When the soul speaks through the intellect, we learn to think with the mind descended into the heart. When it speaks through the emotions, our feelings are more likely to nurture relationships. When it speaks through the will, our willpower can be harnessed for the common good. When it speaks through the ego, we gain a sense of self that gives us the courage to speak truth to power. Every human faculty, as it becomes more soulful, can help us negotiate the complex terrain of life on the Möbius strip. The soul is shy. Spaces designed to welcome the soul and support the inner journey are rare, but the principles and practices that shape such spaces are neither new nor untested. Some are embedded in monastic tradition, for the monastery is the archetypal community of solitudes. Some emerged over 400 years of Quaker faith and practice. Some were revived in the transpersonal psychology movement of the mid-20th century. And some are embodied in the processes of spiritual formation that can be found at the heart of most of the world's great wisdom traditions. Formation may be the best name for what happens in a circle of trust, because the word refers historically to soul work done in community. But a quick disclaimer is in order. Since formation sometimes means a process quite contrary to the one described in this book, a process in which the pressure of orthodox doctrine, sacred text, and institutional authority is applied to the misshapen soul in order to conform it to the shape dictated by some theology. This approach is rooted in the idea that we are born with souls deformed by sin, and our situation is hopeless until the authorities form us properly. But all of that is turned upside down by the principles of a circle of trust. I applaud the theologian who said that the idea of humans being born alienated from the Creator would seem an abominable concept. Here, formation flows from the belief that we are born with souls in perfect form. As time goes on, we are subject to powers of deformation from within as well as without that twist us into shapes alien to the shape of the soul. But the soul never loses its original form and never stops calling us back to our birthright integrity. In a circle of trust, the powers of deformation are held at bay long enough for the soul to emerge and speak its truth. Here we are not required to conform ourselves to some external template. Instead, we are invited to conform our lives to the shape of our own souls. In a circle of trust, we can grow our selfhood like a plant, from the potential within the seed of the soul in ground made fertile by the quality of our relationships, toward the light of our own wholeness, trusting the soul to know its own shape better than any external authority possibly can. What sort of space gives us the best chance to hear soul truth and follow it? A space defined by principles and practices that honor the soul's nature and needs. What is that nature, and what are those needs? My answer draws on the only metaphor I know that reflects the soul's essence while honoring its mystery. The soul is like a wild animal. Like a wild animal, the soul is tough, resilient, resourceful, savvy, and self-sufficient. It knows how to survive in hard places. I learned about these qualities during my bouts with depression. In that deadly darkness, the faculties I had always depended on collapsed. My intellect was useless. My emotions were dead. My will was impotent. My ego was shattered. But from time to time, deep in the thickets of my inner wilderness, I could sense the presence of something that knew how to stay alive even when the rest of me wanted to die. That something was my tough and tenacious soul. Yet, despite its toughness, the soul is also shy. Just like a wild animal, it seeks safety in the dense underbrush, especially when other people are around. If we want to see a wild animal, we know that the last thing we should do is go crashing through the woods yelling for it to come out. But if we will walk quietly into the woods, sit patiently at the base of a tree, breathe with the earth, and fade into our surroundings, the wild creature we seek might put in an appearance. We may see it only briefly and only out of the corner of an eye, but the sight is a gift we will always treasure as an end in itself. Unfortunately, community in our culture too often means a group of people who go crashing through the woods together, scaring the soul away. In spaces ranging from congregations to classrooms, we preach and teach, assert and argue, claim and proclaim, admonish and advise, and generally behave in ways that drive everything original and wild into hiding. Under these conditions, the intellect, emotions, will, and ego may emerge, but not the soul. We scare off all the soulful things, like respectful relationships, goodwill, and hope. A circle of trust is a group of people who know how to sit quietly in the woods with each other and wait for the shy soul to show up. The relationships in such a group are not pushy, but patient. They are not confrontational, but compassionate. They are filled not with expectations and demands, but with abiding faith in the reality of the inner teacher and in each person's capacity to learn from it. The poet Rumi captures the essence of this way of being together. A circle of lovely, quiet people becomes the ring on my finger. Few of us have experienced large-scale communities that possess these qualities, but we may have had one-on-one relationships that do. By reflecting on the dynamics of these small-scale circles of trust, we can sharpen our sense of what a larger community of solitudes might look like, and remind ourselves that two people who create safe space for the soul can support each other's inner journey. Think, for example, about someone who helped you grow toward true self. When I think about such a person, it is my father who first comes to mind. Though he was himself a hard-working and successful businessman, he did not press me toward goals that were his rather than mine. Instead, he made space for me to grow into my own selfhood. Throughout high school, I got mediocre grades, every one of which I earned, although I always did quite well on standardized intelligence tests. I look back with amazement on the fact that not once did my father demand that I live up to my potential. He trusted that if I had a gift for academic life, it would flower in its own time, as it did when I went to college. The people who help us grow toward true self offer unconditional love, neither judging us to be deficient nor trying to force us to change, but accepting us exactly as we are. And yet this unconditional love does not lead us to rest on our laurels. Instead, it surrounds us with a charged force field that makes us want to grow from the inside out, a force field that is safe enough to take the risks and endure the failures that growth requires. That is not only what my father did for me. It is an element in every such story I have ever heard. We grow toward true self in a space where our growth is not driven by external demands, but drawn forward by love into our own best possibilities. Here is one way to understand the relationships in a circle of trust. They combine unconditional love, or regard, with hopeful expectancy, creating a space that both safeguards and encourages the inner journey. In such a space, we are freed to hear our own truth, touch what brings us joy, become self-critical about our faults, and take risky steps toward change, knowing that we will be accepted no matter what the outcome. There is another one-on-one relationship that reveals, in microcosm, how we are called to relate to each other in a circle of trust. I am thinking of the experience some of us have had at the bedside of a dying person, accompanying someone who is making the most solitary journey of all. When we sit with a dying person, we gain two critical insights into what it means to be alone together. First, we realize that we must abandon the arrogance that often distorts our relationships, the arrogance of believing that we have the answer to the other person's problem. When we sit with a dying person, we understand that what is before us is not a problem to be solved, but a mystery to be honored. As we find a way to stand respectfully on the edge of that mystery, we start to see that all of our relationships would be deepened if we could play the fixer role less frequently. Second, when we sit with a dying person, we realize that we must overcome the fear that often distorts our relationships, the fear that causes us to turn away when the other reveals something too vexing, painful, or ugly to bear. Death may be all of this and more, and yet we hold the dying person in our gaze, our hearts, our prayers, knowing that it would be disrespectful to avert our eyes, that the only gift we have to offer in this moment is our undivided attention. When people sit with a dying person, they know that they are doing more than taking up space in the room. But if you ask them to describe what that more is, they have a hard time finding the right words. And when the words come, they are almost always some variant on, "I was simply being present." We learn to practice presence when we sit with a dying person, to treat the space between us as sacred, to honor the soul and its destiny. Our honoring may be wordless, or perhaps mediated by speech that the dying person cannot hear. Yet this honoring somehow keeps us connected as we bear witness to another's journey into the ultimate solitude. I am not privy to reports from the other side, so I do not know what having someone practicing presence means to a person who is dying. But I have a hunch that comes from my own experience. When I went into a deadly darkness that I had to walk alone, the darkness called clinical depression, I took comfort and strength from those few people who neither fled from me nor tried to save me, but were simply present to me. Their willingness to be present revealed their faith that I had the inner resources to make this treacherous trek, quietly bolstering my faltering faith that perhaps in fact I did. I do not know yet what a dying person experiences, but this I do know. I would sooner die in the company of someone practicing simple presence than I would die alone. And I know this as well. We are all dying all the time. So why wait for the last few hours before offering each other our presence? It is a gift we can give and receive right now in a circle of trust. Two Solitudes. No one has described the relationships that characterize a circle of trust more beautifully or more precisely than the poet Rainer Maria Rilke, who wrote of the love that consists in this, that two solitudes protect and border and salute each other. A love of this sort makes the soul feel safe for at least two reasons. First, it excludes the violence we sometimes do to each other in love's name. I do not mean the overt physical violence of an abusive relationship. I mean the subtle violence we do when we violate the other's solitude with the intention of being helpful. In Zorba the Greek, Nikos Kazantzakis tells a tale about the way some efforts to help can do real harm. One morning, I discovered a cocoon in the bark of a tree, just as the butterfly was making a hole in the case preparing to come out. I waited a while, but it was too long appearing, and I was impatient. I bent over it and breathed on it to warm it. I warmed it as quickly as I could, and the miracle began to happen before my eyes, faster than life. The case opened, the butterfly started slowly crawling out, and I shall never forget my horror when I saw how its wings were folded back and crumpled. The wretched butterfly tried with its whole body to unfold them. Bending over it, I tried to help it with my breath, in vain. It needed to be hatched out patiently, and the unfolding of the wings should be a gradual process in the sun. Now it was too late. My breath had forced the butterfly to appear all crumpled before its time. It struggled desperately, and a few seconds later died in the palm of my hand. That little body is, I do believe, the greatest weight I have on my conscience. For I realize today that it is a mortal sin to violate the great laws of nature. We should not hurry. We should not be impatient. But we should confidently obey the eternal rhythm. On rare occasions, we